Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, July 22nd edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, available via podcast on iTunes and the Stitcher app, as well as on the blog on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. You can also visit our Facebook page or our Twitter page for more information about the show, upcoming shows, or to comment on what you hear. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour with the theme of stories that emphasize female friendships. The author of our second book, Emily Gould, said in response to whether or not her book was consciously feminist that it was a feminist thing to write, quote-unquote, having a book that unapologetically focuses on women's friendships without romance as a framing device. And a recent biblioracle column in the Chicago Tribune by John Warner expressed a disapproval of the name of the category women's fiction on the grounds that it forced into a niche books written by women about women's stories and books that would appeal to men too when well written. And in that piece, he singled out our first author's book as an example of an appealing story that needn't be relegated to a section that was labeled specifically for women. So we'll put a link to that article on the website with the podcast for the show. And so during the second half of the show, I'll be on with Emily Gould, author of the novel Friendship. But first up, author Lisa Lutz. Lisa is the New York Times bestselling author of The Spellman Files, Curse of the Spellmans, Revenge of the Spellmans, The Spellman Strike Again, Trail of the Spellmans, Spellman 6, The Next Generation, Heads You Lose with David Hayward, and the children's book, How to Negotiate Everything. Lisa has won the Alex Award and has been nominated for the Edgar Award for Best Novel. Although she attended UC Santa Cruz, our very own UC Irvine, the University of Leeds in England, and San Francisco State University, she does not have a bachelor's degree. She wrote a screenplay, Plan B, a mob comedy. And Lisa lives in upstate New York. Her latest book is How to Start a Fire. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Lisa.
Hey, Nicole. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm glad you could join us. And can we start by having you introduce your book? Can you tell us about How to Start a Fire?
Sure. It's about three friends, Anna, Kate, and George, over the course of about 20 years. And each chapter is a different place and a different year, and the years are completely jumbled, and I realize that that sounds a bit crazy, but it's sort of about taking a person's life and turning it into a mystery, or maybe another way to look at it is sort of whenever you meet a person, they slowly come into complete view over time. You get different pieces of information about them, and I kind of wanted to do that with my three characters. But it's about, you know, it's about friendship and how it ebbs and flows over time. But it's also about a significant event that all three characters saw very differently.
Well, I'd like to come back what you're calling the jumbling of time a little bit later. But getting into the book some more, can we talk about how it began for you? What was the first image for you with this book? Did it start with a setting or...
I think on some level it started maybe 15 years ago when I wrote a screenplay about three friends. And for some reason it was about them. I mean, this is like the worst screenplay ever, where they decide to dig a lake. But it was more, my interest was in writing about women that are, I know, the kinds of women I know, that are odd. And, you know, and to reflect the kind of conversations they have, which are not, like, when I talk to my friends, we're not talking about boys, you know? We're just talking about things. And that was an interest that I had. But I think that the first scene I wrote, I knew that I had the character of Anna, and I wanted to show her first in college and just sort of the way you're just so kind of full of life and fearless. And then I wanted to show what happened to her later. And I wanted it not to connect. And so to have the book be about piecing together what happens in between.
Mm. And so with the idea of exploring those friendships and those dialogues, did you know from the get-go that it would be told in alternating point of view, or did you ever think of sticking with Anna as the protagonist or something?
No, I think originally I thought it was going to be Anna's story, and then the other characters just became too important, and I realized, and, you know, I think Kate was the sort of the second one to really... I mean, ultimately, in some ways, Kate's the hero of the story, and that I didn't see coming. More than any other book, this is a book that came together in the writing of it. You know, it's many drafts, and many things were rearranged, and a lot of things were played with until I finally figured out what it was that I really needed to do.
I'm talking to Lisa Lutz. Her new novel is How to Start a Fire. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And the three characters that you mentioned, they all have their own demons and their own story arcs. And so in terms of developing them, it sounds like it was sequential, first Anna, then Kate, and then George, or is that incorrect? Or how did you go about developing those three distinct characters?
You know, it was interesting. They developed over time. I had, obviously, when you start with a character, you have some feeling. I mean, Anna was the clearest to me, but then... And George was the one I had to fight the hardest to find, and that came much, much later. And it, you know, it's sometimes it was through scenes in terms of their reaction. Like my editor at one point told me that I had to figure out how to like George, and that was where it was her relationships with her sons where I was like, okay, now I know what to do with her. But I didn't know what to do with her before because she was the least familiar to me. While she's the most traditional woman, to me, she was the least familiar.
And once you made that decision to go with the alternating, and you had the three characters, was it difficult to balance those three throughout the story and to feel like they were each getting their, you know, fair share of the spotlight?
Yeah, in revisions, I definitely had to work on that a lot.
So, would you read to us from the book?
Sure. So, this is actually the very first chapter. 2005, Lincoln, Nebraska. Are you lost? The man asked. No, she said. Where are you headed? Don't know. Seat taken? He asked. As you can see, it's empty, she said. He sat down across the table. A road map of the lower 48 states separated the man and the woman. It also joined them in a way. Wasn't an invitation, she said, not pleasantly, not unpleasantly. He ignored the comment. He ate lunch in this diner every day at noon. It felt kind of like home. He didn't need an invitation to sit in his own dining room. So, let me get this straight. You don't know where you're going, but you're not lost? That's the gist of it. On a road trip? Something like that. You picked a good place to begin a journey. We're practically smack in the middle of the country. And the middle of nowhere, she said. He couldn't argue with that and nodded in agreement. My name's Bill. Hello, Bill. You got a name? Everyone has a name. Bill waited. He was expecting a name. She wasn't sure which one to use. Kate, she said. It felt odd saying her real name again. That's a nice, simple name. I guess so. You should be careful, Kate. A woman alone on the road, never a great idea, Bill said. I can take care of myself, she said. Some people, you just don't know. You don't know what they're capable of. I think I do. Been around a while, Bill said. She couldn't argue with him about that. The lines were etched deep on his forehead like a maze of estuaries, with his hair running from the shore. He'd managed to avoid the middle-aged spread, but his gut still seemed a little soft. She knew he meant well. She also knew he'd keep talking because he was tired of hanging on to all that wisdom. I'm sure you have. Can I get the check, please? She asked the waitress. A woman shouldn't be traveling alone, Bill continued, especially if she's got no particular destination. I know you think I'm just an old man prattling on and I should mind my own business, but I got a daughter about your age, and I would tell her the same thing. Has your daughter ever killed a man? She asked. Excuse me? Kate leaned in and spoke in a whisper so as not to disturb the other patrons. Has your daughter ever killed a man? Of course not, Bill said. I didn't mean for it to happen, but it did. Kate said it to silence him. She was surprised how well it worked. It slipped off her tongue so easily this time. She wondered why that was. Bill placed his hands on the map and traced the continental divide. Kate paid the check and carefully folded up the map. She smiled warmly at Bill, just to ease the tension. Excuse me, I have to be somewhere.
Thank you. That was Lisa Lutz, reading from her new novel, How to Start a Fire. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And so with that section, I was struck because I forgot that it started with that scene, but it reminded me of a comment that I saw in a column about your book, that you use this jumbled timeline to leverage the suspense and the mystery. And I mean, it's like you were saying how you discover things about people in a nonlinear way. And so can you talk some more about using that structure? I mean, was it hard to keep track of what was revealed when? And did any of it get written in a linear way and then, you know, pieced together differently later? Or how did you go about achieving that?
It was written mostly in the order that you're reading it, but obviously we had to play with the pieces as I was working on revisions. And I knew, I mean, it was definitely hard keeping track of things, but there were certain things I was clear on when I wanted to reveal them. So it was more about kind of figuring out the pacing and keeping the tension when there weren't reveals happening. But, you know, even though I have never had a true crime novel punished, meaning something that can accurately be called, like, you know, that properly fits in the genre, I still, like, live in that world. And, you know, the Spellman books are basically structured like crime novels. And I always think that I would probably never write a book without its being part of that genre to a certain extent. And this was my way of taking a sort of a book about relationships and writing it like a crime novel.
Oh, that's interesting. And how about the ending of your story? Did you know early on how the book would end? Were you writing toward it, or how did that happen?
I knew, like, you mean the very, very end?
Like, that's what I'm referring to, but I'm happy to hear about, you know.
I don't know that I knew the end. When I think about, like, when I started this so long ago, which was, like, 8 years ago, I had a different end in mind. But at that point, it was more of Anna's story. So it really did, it came to me as I was writing it. And I think, yeah, it really did. I don't know if I was in the middle of the chapter when I just sort of, like, it finally came together. But I knew that, you know, I knew the pieces that would lead up to the end, but the actual end, I think, was something that just surprised me.
Mm-hmm. And those 8 years that you said you were working on the book, were you working on the Spellman series at the same time, or how did that fit together?
Well, it was, what happened was, when my agent was sort of selling Spellman, there was a lapse in time, and she told me to immediately get started working on something else so I wouldn't be thinking about whether she was selling my book or not, which is great advice. So, and I didn't really know that the Spellmans was going to be sold as a series. Like, it never occurred to me to write a second Spellman book. So six later. So I started working on How to Start a Fire, and then, you know, we got a two-book deal, so then I immediately dropped that and began working on the Spellman books. And I didn't have much time for a while. I wrote four Spellman books, and then I had the idea for Heads You Lose, which created these, like, two-week or longer lapses in time while my co-author was working on his chapter. So then I came back to How to Start a Fire during those times. So when he was working on his chapter, I was able to get a good chunk done there. And then I worked on it mostly after, in the last couple of years.
And a little earlier when you were talking about revisions and developing characters, you used the word we. And so was that your agent, you said, or was that an editor who was helping you with those developments?
Both, but I think I use we a lot. Like, I'm not a writer who can write in a bubble. Like, I'm very dependent on editors and readers. I mean, they're just these people I go to. So, yeah, my agent reads everything. But my editor worked really intensely with me on How to Start a Fire. It was a very intense, rough edit. And it was the first time I'd ever gotten an edit back where it was almost like we'd gone backwards with one of the drafts, where I had to just kind of take out what I'd written, and she really didn't like it, and I wasn't understanding what she was saying. And it was just difficult.
Can you walk backwards a bit in your writing career? And was there a point where you had to like consciously let go to let someone in that closely to, you know, into your work?
Because I started out writing screenplays, I think it's a little bit easier for screenwriters than people who start out writing novels or anything that's more inherently private. Like, if you write screenplays, you know someone is going to mess with them and tell you what to do. So it's a lot easier. It's a much easier leap. So the difference is when you write a script, the people giving you notes can often be idiots, and the notes can be completely stupid. But I rarely get a bad note from a book editor. So I don't tend to have a big problem with the editing process. Sometimes it's just frustrating, and the most frustrating parts are when you didn't see it coming. Usually the notes are things that when you get them, you're like, oh, yeah. I mean, you kind of feel like, I was just too lazy to address that on my own, or I didn't quite know how. But it's when it blindsides you, and then you realize you have to do it. That's when it's the most difficult.
That's really interesting. Of course, you know, once you said that, yeah, screenplay writing is another animal. And so regarding that screenwriting experience that you had, are there other ways that it impacted your novel writing? Like, for instance, you've been praised for your skill at dialogue, and also did it affect your approach to structure, or do you see any other traces of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I have a writer friend who says that he thinks all screenwriters tend to be less descriptive and write. He thinks we're sparer and not in a good way. I disagree with that, but I do think that it took me a while to get used to, like, the freedom of novels. I think I finally, like, let loose with How to Start a Fire. What I do prefer in screenplays is that when you're reading dialogue, you can almost hear it as you would hear a conversation. So it feels like eavesdropping, and there's that nice rhythm to it, whereas in a book you have often, you know, all the descriptives, the he said, the she said, all the other stuff that's going on that sometimes is great, but sometimes it just doesn't let you, I don't know, really feel like how a conversation unfolds. So I will often just put it into a play format in my books, or transcript format, because I want the readers to just read the dialogue sometimes.
And we mentioned your screenplay, Plan B, and it was made into a movie in 2000, right?
Yes.
But then on your website, you say that after that you vowed you would never write another screenplay. So can you talk about that? Why not?
Well, I mean, never say never. I mean, I'm sort of adapting something I wrote now, so I'm a liar. But it was a really bad experience. And, you know, that script, Plan B, which is like the dumbest. I mean, even when I was writing it, I knew it was a really stupid idea. It's a mob comedy. Very, very silly. I worked on that for 10 years of my life. I probably wrote 40 drafts of that script. And by the time I was done, it was the thing I was best at in the world. And that was very disturbing to me. And it turned into a movie that's really unwatchable. I mean, When I showed it to my mother, when it was done, she said, "Wow, that was annoying." And it really is.
And how about the women digging the lake? That wasn't in that movie.
No, that was the strangest script ever. I can't believe I even let people read it. I think it was called Unlucky. Yeah.
Well, I know you're changing gears. I know you're aware of John Warner's Biblioracle column that I mentioned in the intro. But for listeners who aren't familiar, and just to show you what I want to ask next, I wanted to give you the gist with an excerpt. So women's fiction is not a genre like suspense or science fiction, labels that may help help readers predispose to that type of narrative. Women's fiction is not a meaningful category. Fiction by women, fiction about women. If it's the former, try putting it on Toni Morrison or Patricia Highsmith. If it's the latter, hello, Jonathan Franzen, the king of women's fiction. When we call something women's fiction, we are declaring that it is a subcategory of the real thing, not acceptable. And so he, you know, mentioned your book as an example of a misleading women's fiction label slapped on a work. And so what was your reaction when you were reading this piece, or is your reaction?
Oh, I was incredibly, incredibly grateful that he wrote that. Because I was just frustrated. And I remember when I saw the review, it said something about how I was like firmly in the terrain of women's fiction. And it's just like, why? Why do you say that? Because it's a book about women? You know, it's like we're 50% of the population, and this is going on. And I mean, the fight for me is beyond that. It's sort of like, I'm now fighting with my publisher, and I shouldn't even be saying this, over how they're going to put they want to put pictures of women on the paperback jacket, like, so it looks like those really dumb kind of chick lit covers. And it's been really disturbing to me that this, everything gets marginalized when you're a woman. If a man wrote a book similar to this about men, it would have been treated so differently. It's just exhausting.
Yeah. That's incredible, actually, about the cover, because the hardback cover is stark and appropriately, I don't know, serious looking.
It's a great cover, and for whatever reason, there's this need to sort of dumb things down and pander to an audience that I don't even really believe exists.
Right. And I liked the column as well, and I especially like that he called the industry on that hypocrisy, because, you know, if it's not, it has to be both of those things, right? If it's not written by a woman, then it's not women's fiction, even though the same book written by a woman would be considered women's fiction. So
yeah, there are moments where I think, oh wow, a nom de plume, that would be great, but you know. This book would be weird if some guy's like writing a book about three women. I mean, I realize that wouldn't quite work, but I just think people don't think we're interesting or as interesting as men.
I sense that too. Well, Lisa, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I need to ask you if you have any writing advice for our writer listeners, especially those who are working on finishing up a project. Can you talk a little bit about coming to that finishing point?
Finishing a project. You just got to finish it. I think that's the way I roll. You can fix everything later, but just write to the end.
Great. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. It was great. I really appreciate it.
That was Lisa Lutz, author of the new novel, How to Start a Fire, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. During the second part of the show, Emily Gould, author of the novel Friendship, will be here. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with novelist Lisa Lutz. Next up, I'll be speaking with novelist Emily Gould. Emily, with Zareen Jaffrey, is the co-author of the young adult novel Hex Education. She is also the author of a collection of essays and The Heart Says Whatever. She is the co-owner, with Ruth Curry, of the indie bookstore, the indie ebook store, Emily Books, and the former co-editor of Gawker.com. Her novel, Friendship, was published by FSG and is now out in paperback. And I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Emily.
Thanks. It's really good to be on the show.
Well, to start off, could you introduce your novel, Friendship, to us and tell us what the book's about?
Sure. Friendship is about two friends who are both around 30. They're best friends, and they start out, one of them, Amy, is doing pretty well in her life, is sort of stable, has reached sort of a kind of a boring stasis, but still feels very, unfulfilled, she has unfulfilled ambitions. And her best friend, Bev, is really not doing well at all. She is struggling to find work after dropping out of grad school, and she still lives in a crappy apartment with roommates. And then over the course of the novel, they kind of, they don't trade places exactly, but things start going really badly for Amy, and weirdly a bit better for Bev, in spite of the fact that Bev gets unexpectedly pregnant. So that's pretty much the beginning of the book.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you have a varied work history. And so this is your first novel, save the co-authoring of the young adult novel. And so,
I don't really count that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
it was a lot of fun, but Zareen and I worked together at a publishing house when I was in my early 20s, and young adult novels were so hot right then. Mm-hmm. We sort of thought, we'll write a young adult novel. How hard could it be? And it turns out that it's really hard, actually. But that was sort of my first foray into trying to publish books. But mm-hmm. I think of it as mostly Zareen and I did a fun project together, basically.
So with regard to Friendship, your adult novel, how did it come to be? How did you come to want to write it and to actually write it?
I was kind of struggling after my essay collection, And the Heart Says Whatever, was published. I hadn't founded Emily Books yet with Ruth, my best friend, and I was just flailing. I didn't have any clear sense of what should happen next in my career. And my book, which I still really like my essay collection, but it definitely did not have a very warm critical reception when it was first published. And I think people still really associated me with Gawker. It was kind of a rough couple of years in there. And so I started writing Friendship. I was mostly, experimenting with writing in a third person, which I've never done before, ever. And it sort of evolved from being sort of an exercise and sort of tricking myself into starting to write again, which had been really hard for me after having sort of my ego raked over the coals after And the Heart Says Whatever came out. But it did eventually become with a lot of help from my friends and my writing group, really, and also my then boyfriend, who is now my husband, Keith Gessen. It turned out to actually be a novel, surprising me a lot, because I'd never thought of myself as a novelist, and I was not convinced that I was really writing a novel until I was pretty far along in it. So.
And yet you have this interesting quote in Interview magazine about the challenge of creating characters. You said, "Nothing trains you better to write fiction than being really good at writing about your own interiority." And so, can you talk some more about that? How the habits and insights of your earlier work as a blogger and essayist served you when you went to write fiction?
It's such a good question. I do think that first person writing and fiction are they're more related than maybe we tend to think sometimes. I mean, I I do think that you have to, in order to write good and convincing first-person memoir essays, you do have to sort of think of yourself as a character and have compassion for yourself or, like, past versions of yourself, the same way that it's really important to have compassion for your characters. I always am annoyed when I feel like I'm reading a novel and the and it seems that the author is contemptuous of some of the people who she's writing about, or all of them. There are a lot of novels like that where you sort of feel like, why did you want to spend so much time in the heads of people who you hate? But that being said, though, I do feel like I wrote this book in a way to sort of exorcise parts of my personality that I felt like ready to be done with. Amy, especially, is sort of like, Amy is sort of everything about myself in my late 20s that I didn't like about myself, but just like in a person. and so I set up a little bit of a challenge for myself in terms of like feeling empathy for a person who is actually like an assortment of the things about yourself that you sort of resent and wish you could change, you know? I don't want to make it sound like this is like a therapeutic exercise, but when I reread the book now, it feels like, because like it's been a couple of years since I finished it, that's what I see now when I read the book, especially Amy. I read Amy's things that are written in Amy's sort of the voice of her her like interior monologue, and I'm like, oh my God, you idiot. So maybe I'm not doing that well with the empathy, actually.
Well, I want to hear some more about that, because on the show sometimes we talk about velocity. So especially when you're talking about themes that are closer to the author, like those, you have to, it seems if you don't write fast enough, then you outgrow the part of you that was interested in looking at that or able to access that. And so did you find yourself racing against the clock in any sense when you were doing revisions or relating differently to the material?
I always feel like it's a huge gift to be given more time, like as much time to revise as possible, because you do get to see things that you've written from the perspective of, you know, a slightly more, let's hope, evolved version of yourself. And I definitely feel this with first person things. I wrote this essay for an anthology called MFA versus NYC that came out, I guess, a little more than a year ago. And I had over a year to revise it. If it had been published, you know, immediately after I wrote it, the version of that essay that would have gone out into the world I can't even imagine. Like I would regret it so much. I would wake up every day thinking, "Oh God," and just wincing at the knowledge that it was out in the world. But the year gave me time to sort of get perspective on my own thoughts. And I do feel the same way about friendship. Like, I wrote it at a time when I was really broken, unemployed. The first draft was sold. You know, I was still like really, I was still really struggling at that time to figure out what I was meant to do. And in the intervening like year or two that I had working on it with my editor, I got a full-time job, and I was doing the revisions like in little, you know, drips and drabs on the weekends when I could. And it was just a totally different, perspective on, you know, writing and time to write and time to like be able to think about things at my leisure became these like enormous luxuries to me. Whereas before they had been like almost burdens. I feel like I had even like a little too much time on my hands, you know? Mm. And I'll certainly never feel that way again, because now I have a child.
Well, I'm talking to Emily Gould. Her novel is Friendship. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Emily, would you read to us from your book, Friendship?
Yeah, sure. I'm just going to read the first three pages of Friendship. And they are written in the voice of Bev, who is the less fortunate friend. The temp agency's application was only 4 pages long, but somehow Bev hadn't managed to fill it out. she told herself that she would do it on the subway on the morning of the interview, but then the train was so crowded that it was impossible to even reach into her bag to get the form. Also, J.R. Pinkman was in her subway car, waving to her from his own packed corner. She smiled. It was nice to see someone she knew in this context, to be reminded of who she was underneath her costume. Dressed corporately, the woman at the temp agency had told her in an email. And now she was riding the B train at 8:30 a.m. in a taupe trench coat over a jacket and skirt that were slightly different shades of black. But while it was good to catch a glimpse of the familiar face, she didn't want to actually talk to JR. She wanted to grab a seat when the train let half its passengers off at Grand Street and then use the remaining 10 minutes of the commute to fill out her form. She waved back at him, but dropped her gaze and dipped her head down, conveying preoccupied busyness and giving him tacit permission to do the same. The train stopped at Grand Street, and J.R. bumped and pushed down the length of car between himself and Bev. They'd worked together at Warwick Smythe, a literary agency, and Bev had even maybe had a slight crush on him when she'd first met him. But in this morning's subway light, no one looked too great. J.R. was also carrying several dingy tote bags, presumably containing several different crappy manuscripts in addition to the one in his hand. "Where are you headed?" he asked, gesturing at Bev's outfit. "I'm temping," she said. It felt good to admit it, and then, in the silence that followed, less good to have done so. "I thought you were in grad school." "I was, for a year," she smile winced. It started to seem like this huge waste of money, but now I have to start paying back the huge amount of money I already wasted." She pointed at the manuscript she was holding, desperate to redirect the conversation and to remind him and herself that she'd left the literary agency for a good reason. "Reading anything good?" Dare shook the sheaf of printed-out pages in his hand. "Huh, are you kidding? It's just more of Warwick's memoirs." J.R. was one of a team of assistants employed mostly to type up and copy edit their ancient boss's never-to-be-published memoirs, and also to roll him to the restroom every half hour or so. "You must be so thrilled that you don't have to think about any of this BS anymore." "Yeah, thrilled. Unemployment is thrilling." The train shuddered to a halt at Broadway Lafayette. "Well, tell everyone I say hi," Bev said to J.R. "I will. I'll make an announcement about it in the morning meeting," he shouted over the mechanized command to stand clear of the closing doors. "Don't tell them I'm temping," she called after him as he left the train. But he didn't turn around, and Bev wasn't sure whether he'd heard her. She climbed up out of the subway into Bryant Park 5 minutes before the interview was supposed to start and looked around for a spot where she could huddle and fill out the application. The first raindrops of a sudden storm were falling just as she got above ground, and her taupe trench coat immediately developed ugly, dark blotches. She was going to have to buy one of those street vendor umbrellas. They cost only $5, but they were pretty much worthless, so it always seemed like a shame, and $5 represented a depressingly large percentage of Bev's current net worth. Ducking under an overhang by the library steps, she checked the ledge at her elbow for pigeon poop before putting the form down on it. The standard stuff, references, employment history, she completed quickly, then found herself unexpectedly stymied with only a minute left by a question on the last page. "What are your grandest aspirations?" There were spaces for three grand aspirations, each space about half a line long, not even long enough for a full sentence. Bev glanced at her watch, then spent an infinite frozen moment watching a pair of finches hopping around in the grass, yelling their little heads off over a scrap of Jane Cafe cookie. The last time she'd confronted this stupid question had probably been in high school or in church as a teenager. She imagined Teen Bev filling in the blanks with zero hesitation. Number one, serve God. Number two, marry a good Christian. Number three, raise children in the ways of the Lord. Had she believed these were her true goals even then? By freshman year of college, the grand aspirations would already have shifted to number one, read every book, number two, live as far away from the Midwest as possible, and number three, never turn down an opportunity to get drunk.
Thank you.
But sorry.
Oh no. Sorry. We'll stop there. But thank you. That was Emily Gold reading from her novel Friendship, now out in paperback. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. When you were laying out the plot for this book, Did you have signposts for different events or emotional reactions or specific conflicts, or was it all by the seat of your pants? I guess I'm asking whether you had an outline, or how did you set out to write the story?
I did eventually sort of retrofit an outline onto the book after I had a full draft where I did a full draft where way too much happened, and then I did another draft where way too little happened. So I had a sense that the book was about two characters who sort of, you know, if you were, I'm like making a hand gesture that you can't see right now, but like their trajectories, one goes up and the other goes down, and their trajectories sort of intersect in the middle. And I had in mind sort of a sort of like House of Mirth like plot where, especially for the Amy character, you just keep throwing more bad things at her and see how she reacts. It's like you sort of put the character through the ringer, but in every situation she has an opportunity to reverse course, but she keeps missing the opportunities because it's just like not in her character to be able to reverse course. So that was sort of my very basic conception of the plot. And it turned out to be too basic, obviously, because I did get stuck at the end. I couldn't figure out the ending, and I rewrote it. I rewrote it completely, like, throughout, like, the entire latter quarter of the book and started over again from scratch. I want to say 4 times. It was really frustrating. I hope that with my next novel, I will have learned something and I won't have to do that again, because it's just excruciating. Like the day where when you wake up and you look at the book and you realize, okay, there's no way to salvage this. There's nothing to do with it but throw it away. It's horrible. It's like some sort of delicious food has like gone stale or like rotted in your fridge, and you like had, and you're really hungry, but you can't eat it. Oh God, terrible job.
Well, with regard to the subtle humor in the book, is that just your voice, or is that something you worked to draw out in your revisions?
I'm glad that you find it funny. I think sometimes the humor is maybe so subtle that not everyone kind of perceives it as humorous. I think the tone of my writing in general is like, even when it is very serious, there will always be moments when I leaven in the seriousness with at least being like 3/4 kidding about everything, you know? I wanted to sort of walk a tightrope with the tone in this book, and I struggled a little bit at the end because I did want to, by the end of the book, have the emotional stakes be pretty high. And I also did want people to care about the characters, both characters, even though, like I've mentioned, they have moments when they seem very, like, they're not terrible people at all, but they are just sort of benighted, like struggling to see things clearly.
And I'm curious as well about the title. Could you talk about finding it and whether there were any different working titles? Because we talk often on the show about how titles are hard.
They're so hard. Oh my God, it's impossible. I used to, when I worked in book publishing, consider myself sort of like a title savant. Like, I was great at titles, and I was great at coming up with titles for other people, which turns out to be a lot easier than coming up with your own title. And from the experience of writing a book called And the Heart Says Whatever, I learned one thing, which was that you really have to be totally comfortable saying the title of your book out loud a lot of times, because if you're not, it's going to be, if you're saying this in sort of an apologetic way, that's going to be excruciating over and over and over again. So probably better to have a straightforward title that just kind of says what the book is about. And eventually I landed on friendship because that's what the book is about. I mean, just in a very straightforward way. And I sacrificed, you know, search engine optimization, but it seems worth it to me. I went through a similar struggle recently with naming my son, which we had him at home, and so we didn't have to come up with a name before he left the hospital. And so we had a week, and we took it. We took the entire week, and we went completely insane. Like, it was so horrible. we did eventually come up with a name that we're really happy with. But boy, was it down to the wire. I mean, it was like the last possible day. The midwife was calling us and being like, "So, I got to file this form."
Well, I'm biased, but I think boy names are particularly challenging to.
Oh my God, they are, and it's because, well, I have a theory about this, and it is that if you are like, you know, like me, like you have your first child and you're sort of like in your early 30s, you've had a lot of experiences with a lot of different like men, and a lot of names are just like off the list. I'm not talking specifically about sexual experiences, so that is part of it, but it's like, oh, that guy was such a crappy coworker, or like, that guy was a terrible boss, you know, and if that's your first association with a name, it's like, so many names are out. You're almost forced to invent a name or just name your child something kind of like faintly ridiculous, which is of course what I ended up doing. My son's name is Raphael, but I decided to embrace the longer name, the more, I don't know, the name that you have to sort of like take a breath before you say it.
Well, I'm talking to Emily Gold. Her new novel is Friendship. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. But Emily, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I'd love to ask you if you have any writing advice for the writers listening, perhaps in particular for those in a moment of struggle with their writing.
Well, something that I tell myself a lot, this is sort of in the vein of like letting yourself off the hook and not feeling so guilty all the time about everything advice, is that it doesn't really matter ultimately, I think, how much time you have to write or sort of the conditions of your life around writing. The work will get done. It will take like as much time as it needs. It will never get done as quickly as you want it to, ever, 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 no matter. There's nothing that you can really do to make it go faster. Wait, is this uplifting or depressing? Like, it's kind of both, but it's just like, it's really the only thing that I've learned in the last 10 years, that you can push and push and push and it won't help. Like, or you can be super lazy and it won't hurt. Like, it will eventually, if there is a book, like, you will eventually extract that book from yourself. Eventually. That's the key word.
Well, Emily, thanks so much for being on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was author Emily Gould. Her novel Friendship is now available in paperback, published by FSG. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, Barbara is back. She'll be talking to Bay Area literary agent Felicia F. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.